Okay, thank you. I'm going to be talking about information in my talk, quantum information. When we think about information, we're reminded of the remarkable progress taken by our information technology in recent years. I have this laptop, and it seems like a hot machine. But we all recognize that technologies that seem impressive to us today are going to be replaced in the future by new technologies that we can't really expect to be able to imagine today. Nevertheless, it's fun to speculate about future technologies. And I'll admit, I'm not the ideal person to engage in that type of speculation, since I'm not an engineer. I'm a theoretical physicist, and I can't claim to be particularly knowledgeable about how my computer works. But as a physicist, I know that the crowning intellectual achievement of the 20th century was the development of quantum theory. And it's natural for a physicist to wonder how the development of quantum theory in the 20th century is going to impact 21st century technologies. As far as information is concerned, to a physicist, information is something that we can encode and store in the state of some physical system. But deep down, we know that all physical systems are really quantum systems, so information is something that we can encode and store in a quantum state. And information carried by quantum systems has some notoriously counterintuitive properties, so physicists sometimes speak of the weirdness of quantum theory. And we relish that weirdness and take great pride in it. But we're also beginning to ask in recent years whether it's possible to put the weirdness to work. Can we exploit the unusual properties of quantum information to perform tasks that wouldn't be possible in a less weird classical world? And that desire to put weirdness to work is driving the emergence of a new field, which we call quantum information science, which I think derives much of its intellectual vitality from three central themes or ideas: quantum computing, quantum cryptography, and quantum error correction. So my goal is to explain a little bit about these ideas in my talk today. Quantum theory itself is, of course, a subject that's over 100 years old, but these ideas have begun to draw substantial attention only in relatively recent times. To get started, we should recall some basic facts about information. We know that any amount of classical information can be expressed in terms of indivisible units, bits of information. And we might envision a bit as an object, like a ball, that can be either one of two colors, like, let's say, red or green. And because bits are valuable, we can store one carefully by putting it in a box. And then later on, when I open the box, the color ball that I put in comes out again, so I can recover a bit and read it. Well, quantum information, information carried by a quantum system, also can be expressed in terms of indivisible units, what we call quantum bits, or qubits for short. And for our purposes, we can think of a qubit again as an object, which can be either one of two colors, but where now we can store the object in a box through either one of two complementary doors, where those doors correspond to two different ways we could prepare or measure the state of some simple quantum system. Now, if I store information in one of these quantum boxes through either door number one or door number two, and then later on I open the same door again, then the color that I put in comes out again. I can recover and read it just as though it were classical information. But on the other hand, if I put information into door number one, say, and then later on I open the other door, door number two, what would come out of the box would be completely random and unpredictable and have nothing to do with what I had put in the box in the first place. Well, correspondingly, I could put information in a quantum box through door number two, and then later on I could open door number two again. The color I put in comes out again, just as though the information were classical. But if I put information in door number two, and then later on I open the other door, door number one in this case, then what comes out is random and completely uncorrelated with what we put in. So to read quantum information, you have to do it the right way, and if you try to do it the wrong way, you'll damage the information. Well, we can appreciate a consequence of that if we think about copying quantum information, copying qubits. What would it mean to have a qubit copy machine? It would mean that if I'd put information in one of these boxes through door number one, and then the copier built a duplicate box, then I could open door number one of the original and of the duplicate, and the color I put in would come out of both boxes. And if, on the other hand, I had put information in door number two, and I built a duplicate box, then if I opened door number two of the original and the duplicate, the color that I put in originally would come out of both boxes. But in fact, there's no such machine. There's no physical process which can copy the state of an unknown qubit. Roughly speaking, the problem is that in order to make a copy of what's in the box, the copier has to look inside the box, and if it makes a correct guess about what door I used, it can copy the information just as though it were classical. But if it guesses wrong and looks inside the wrong door, then it'll damage the information, and there will no longer be any way to make a high-fidelity copy. So we might be able to clone a sheep, but we can't clone a qubit. Now, there are various physical manifestations that the qubit could take. One, for example, is I can consider the polarization state of just a single photon, a particle of light. Even a single photon has a polarization, a direction along which the electric field is aligned. And we can imagine, say, that the polarization is linear along either a horizontal or a vertical direction. Those would correspond to these two distinguishable states that I'm representing with colors, as seen through door number one, for example. But we could, on the other hand, rotate both of the polarization states by 45 degrees. These states, too, are perfectly distinguishable from one another. They correspond to looking in the box through door number two. But if I don't know ahead of time whether the polarization state has been prepared in one of these two states or one of these two, then there isn't any way that I can copy the polarization of a single photon. So that's an example of weirdness. How might we put it to use? Actually, the property that we can't copy unknown quantum states can be useful in quantum cryptography. But let's suppose that Alice here wants to place a private telephone call to her friend Bob, but Alice and Bob are worried that their nosy friend Eve will try to be listening in to their private conversation. So Alice and Bob should use some kind of code, but the trouble is that Eve, aside from being extremely nosy, is also very clever, and Alice and Bob aren't confident that they can think up a code which Eve won't be able to break. Except we do know of one way of encrypting information which really is unbreakable, which can be used if Alice and Bob share a key, which is a string of random bits that Eve doesn't know anything about, but which Alice and Bob both know. If they had such a secret key, then they could communicate in the following way. Alice could take her important message and translate it into a string of bits, and then using the secret key shown in red, she could add the bits of the key, bit by bit, to the bits of the message, obtaining the black ciphertext, the encoded message. So I mean, when in the same place, the blue and red bits are two zeros or two ones, and the ciphertext has a zero, but if it's a zero and a one or a one and zero, then the ciphertext has a one. And that encoded message can then be sent to Bob, and Bob, who also has the secret key, can use it to decipher the message. He can bitwise add the red string to the black string to obtain the clear text, the original message, and read what Alice is saying. When the ciphertext is in transit from Alice to Bob, Eve might intercept it. She might copy it down. But that won't do her any good because the red ciphertext is completely uncorrelated with the secret message. And if Eve doesn't know anything about the key, then she won't be able to decipher anything about the message, even if she captures the ciphertext. So the problem that Alice and Bob need to solve, if they want to communicate privately, is they need to establish a secret key that they can be confident Eve doesn't know anything about. But Alice and Bob might be far apart from one another, they might be living in different cities, and how are they going to establish a key where they can be confident that Eve won't intercept it and learn it? That's a problem that can be solved with quantum information. Here's how. Alice can generate a string of random bits. We can think of them as balls, which are either red or green. And then she can decide at random for each one of those bits to put it into a quantum box through either door number one or door number two. So she prepares all these qubits, her signals, and she sends them over to Bob. Bob receives them, and he decides at random for each one of the qubits to open the box through either door number one or door number two, and he gets a string of bits. Now, with probability 1/2, Bob will choose the same door that Alice chose, and in those cases, what Alice put in the box should be the same thing that Bob found when he opened the door. But with probability 1/2, or about half of the signals, Bob will open the wrong door, and in those cases, what he finds when he opens the box is completely uncorrelated with what Alice put in. But after Bob has received all of the signals, opened the boxes, and it's too late for Eve to tamper with them anymore, Alice can make a public announcement saying for each one of the qubits whether she used door number one or door number two. And then Alice and Bob, through public discussion, can discard the cases in which they use different doors, and they'll retain only the cases in which they should have the same bit. Okay, now what about Eve, though? She's going to try to interfere with the qubits while they're in transit from Alice to Bob, and she'd like to try to learn about the secret key. But Eve doesn't know anything about whether Alice used door number one or door number two for each one of the qubits. So she doesn't know what door to look inside. That means that Alice and Bob can conduct a statistical test to monitor Eve's activity. And if they find that for a significant fraction of the bits, they sacrifice a little bit of their key to conduct this test, and if they find a high error rate, that in a significant fraction of the cases where Bob does use the same door as Alice, that he sees a different color than Alice put in, then they'll know that Eve has been snooping around too much, opening some of the boxes. And in that case, they can reject the key and not use it, because it's not safe to do so, to encrypt a message. On the other hand, if the error rate is low, then they'll have some high confidence about the level of Eve's activity and how much she's learned about the key. And it's actually possible in that case, if the error rate is low enough, to prove that after a little bit of massaging of the key through some classical processing to correct errors in it and to amplify its privacy, that we can guarantee that Eve has negligible information about the final key, no matter what eavesdropping attack she might have used, consistent with the known laws of quantum physics. So in this case, quantum cryptography, this scheme which is called quantum key distribution, the privacy of the protocol is founded on principles of fundamental physics, whereas in most of the cryptographic protocols that are in current use using classical information, we need to make some assumption about the computational resources available to the eavesdropper, or that some problem which isn't proven to be very hard to solve is in fact intractable for the eavesdropper to solve. So this idea of quantum key distribution based on fundamental principles of quantum physics, namely that we can't copy unknown quantum states, has been realized in experiments. Quantum key distribution has been demonstrated by sending single photon signals through optical fibers over distances up to a little longer than 100 kilometers. That's the current limitation due to losses in the fibers, which are imperfect. And in fact, there are now several commercial companies that are trying to market these quantum key distribution systems, so it's fair to say that the technology has not yet proved its viability in the marketplace. So here's one aspect of the weirdness of quantum theory, that we can't copy unknown quantum states, and we've seen one way in which it can be put to work. But the really deep ways in which quantum information is different from classical information, we can only appreciate if we consider states of two or more qubits. So let's suppose that we have two, and they can be far apart from one another. Let's say one is at Caltech in Pasadena, and the other is in the custody of my friend in the Andromeda Galaxy. And some time ago, when both of these qubits were both on Earth, I prepared them in a state that has some interesting properties. Namely, I can open my box through either door number one or door number two for each one of these two-qubit states. And when I do so, what I find is random, completely unpredictable, could be either red or green with probability one-half. And the same is true for my friend in Andromeda. When he opens either door number one or door number two, what comes out is completely random. And that means that neither one of us, by opening his boxes, actually acquires any information, which is kind of peculiar, because with two qubits, we should have been able to store two bits of information. Where is that information hidden? The answer in this case is that all of the information is actually encoded in correlations between what happens when you open a box in Pasadena and you open a box in Andromeda, because it turns out that if I open door number one, I could find red or green, but if my friend opens the same door, he's guaranteed to see the same color. So if I see green through door number one, so does my friend. And similarly, if I open door number two, I could see red or could see green, but my friend is guaranteed to see the same color if he also opens door number two. There are four distinguishable ways in which a box in Pasadena could be correlated with a box in Andromeda. We could either find the same color or opposite colors when we open either door number one or door number two. And we've chosen one of those for a way, so that's two bits of information encoded in the boxes. But what's unusual is that none of that information is accessible locally. It's entirely encoded in correlations between the two boxes. That property of quantum information, this non-locality, that the information can be shared equally by boxes that are far apart from one another, one in Pasadena and one in Andromeda, is what we call quantum entanglement. And it's the really essential way in which quantum information is different from classical information. Of course, correlations themselves are not so unusual. We encounter them all the time in daily life. Usually, I wear two socks which are the same color, and that means that when you look at my left foot, then you can know with certainty before looking what color sock you'll find on my right foot. That's an example of a correlation. And it's kind of similar with the boxes, so here we are testing my theory. You see there's a red sock, and then you know without looking there's a red sock on the other foot. It's kind of similar with the boxes. If you want to know what happens when a box is opened through door number one in Andromeda, you can know for sure by opening the box that's correlated with it through door number one in Pasadena. And likewise, if you want to know what will happen when the box is opened through door number two in Andromeda, you can open door number two in Pasadena to find out. It's almost the same thing, but really the boxes are fundamentally different than the socks. And the essence of the difference is that there's just one way to look at a sock, but there are these two complementary ways to look at a box, to open a qubit. And that means that the correlations among qubits really are richer and much more interesting than correlations among classical bits. This observation that quantum states have this peculiar property that I'm calling quantum entanglement was first explicitly made actually by Einstein and his collaborators in 1935. That was 30 years after Einstein's great 1905 contributions, and arguably this was the last scientific contribution of Einstein's career which has a lasting impact today, although he remained scientifically active for another 20 years. To Einstein, this quantum entanglement was very unsettling. It indicated to him that something was missing from our current understanding of the quantum description of nature, and so he and his co-authors, Podolsky and Rosen, called their paper, "Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete?" That paper stirred some interesting responses, including one that was especially insightful by Schrödinger a few months later. It was Schrödinger who suggested the word entanglement for this phenomenon. And as he put it, the essence of the phenomenon is that the best possible knowledge of a whole does not necessarily include the best possible knowledge of its parts. What Schrödinger meant is that even if we have the most complete possible description of the pair of boxes, it's still impossible to predict what I will find when I open my box through door number one or door number two. And he added, it is rather discomforting that the theory should allow a system to be steered or piloted into one or the other type of state at the experimenter's mercy, in spite of his having no access to it. What Schrödinger meant here is it's up to me to decide by opening door number one or door number two in Pasadena to determine whether a definite result will be found, a predictable result will be found when my friend opens his box in Andromeda through either door number one or door number two. The theory of quantum entanglement didn't advance very much for about 30 years after that, but the next important step was taken by John Bell. And with Bell, we began to think about entanglement in a different way, not just as something strange, but as a kind of resource that can be used to do useful things. The details are not so important, but what Bell described is the type of game that two parties can play, Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob are on the same team. They're trying to cooperate. And in order to win the game, they have to make moves that are correlated with one another, but they're not allowed to communicate during the game. And what Bell said is that he showed that if Alice and Bob are provided with correlated classical bits at the beginning of the game, then they can use those classical correlations to win with a certain probability, 3/4. But if instead they were provided with entangled qubits, with correlated quantum states at the beginning of the game, then they would be able to win with a higher probability, a probability above 85%. So the quantum correlations are stronger than classical ones in the sense that they allow you to do something that you wouldn't be able to do if you had just classical correlations. And experimental physicists have played this game, and they verified that it's possible to win with high probability that Bell showed quantum mechanics predicts. So these unusual non-local correlations really do seem to be a part of the way nature behaves. Einstein didn't like quantum entanglement. He derided it as spooky action at a distance, which sounds even more derisive when you say it in German. But in science, it doesn't really matter what Einstein thinks. Nature is the way she is, as revealed by experiment, and so we have to learn to get along. So I'd like to explain a little bit more concretely what it is about the boxes that are different than the socks. And to do so, I want to tell you about a friend of mine who actually has 3 feet. Now, my friend, every day, wears an even number of red socks. Sometimes it's 0 and sometimes it's 2. And if he wears 2 red socks, any one of his 3 feet might have the green sock. But what this means is that if you look at 2 of my friend's feet, then you know for sure without looking what color sock he'll have on the 3rd foot. Since the number of red socks has to be even, if you see 2 green socks on the first 2 feet, then the last foot has to have a green sock. If you see a red and a green, then you know the last foot has to have a red sock, right? Well, I prepared a state of these 3 qubits, which is kind of similar to my friend's socks. I have 3 boxes. They're far apart from one another. One's in Pasadena, one's in Chicago, and one's in New York. And it turns out that if I open door number 2 of one of these boxes and door number 1 of the other 2, that I always find an even number of red balls. It could be 0 or it could be 2, but it's always an even number. And I know this is definitely true because I've checked it millions of times. Here, I'll show you and maybe you'll be convinced. This time, I opened door number 2 in Chicago and opened door number 1 in the other 2 boxes, and I found 0 red balls, an even number. This time, I opened door number 2 in Pasadena, door number 1 on the other boxes, and I found 2 red balls. I've repeated this experiment over and over a million times, and there's no doubt that every single time I find the same result. I can open door number 2 on any one of the 3 boxes, door number 1 on the other 2, and I always find an even number of red balls. Now, what that means is that if I want to predict what will happen when I open door number 1 in New York, for example, then what I can do, along with my friends, is open door number 1 in Pasadena and door number 2 in Chicago, and if I find green-red, then I know for sure, without actually opening door number 1, that when I do open it, I'll find what in New York? All right, let's check. That's right. It's got to be an even number of red balls. And on the other hand, if I want to know what's going to happen when I open door number 2 in New York, I can open door number 1 in Pasadena and Chicago. In this case, I found 2 green balls. So I know for sure that when I open door number 2 in New York, I'll find what? It works. But here's something that I've never attempted before, and I'm going to do the experiment for the first time today at the KITP. What happens if we open door number 2 on all 3 boxes? Well, to add to the suspense of doing the experiment, it'd be interesting if we could make some kind of prediction about what should happen. Well, how could we make a prediction? Well, let me suppose for the moment, even though I don't really know for sure that it's true, that if I open door number 1 on all 3 boxes, I would find 3 red balls. Okay? Maybe that's not right, but let's just assume that hypothesis for a moment and see where it leads. Well, I claim that if we knew it's true, that when I open door number 1 on all 3 boxes, I would see red, 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 then it must be the case that if I open door number 2 on all 3 boxes, I would have to see green, green, green. Do you see why it's true? Because we know that if when we open door number 1 in Pasadena and Chicago, we see red, red, that it's guaranteed that we'll see green when we open door number 2 in New York, right? And if I open door number 1 in Chicago and New York and I see red, red, it's guaranteed that we'll see green when we open door number 2 in Pasadena. Everybody buy that? Well, of course, I don't really know what's going to happen when I open door number 1 on all the boxes. But something's got to happen. And there are only a limited number of possibilities, 8 possibilities, and we can consider them all. For example, suppose it's the case that I find red, red, green when I open door number 1 on the 3 boxes. Then it's guaranteed that if I actually open door number 2, I would see red, red, green. It's the same kind of reasoning. I know that if I open door number 1 in Pasadena and Chicago and I see red, red, then I have to see green when I open door number 2 in New York. Everybody was convinced of that. And if I saw red-green when I opened door number 1 in Chicago and New York, I would have to see red when I opened door number 2 in Pasadena. It's always an even number of red balls. Well, we can do the same reasoning for every one of the 8 possibilities that could have occurred if I'd opened door number 1 on all the boxes. For each one of these, I can infer what would happen instead if I opened door number 2 on all the boxes. It's an exercise that you can do at home. But we find something kind of interesting. So when I list all the possibilities for door number 2, the number of red balls is always an even number. Sometimes it's 0, sometimes it's 2, it's never 1, and it's never 3. So that's our prediction. Okay? And now it'll be kind of exciting to try the experiment. So let's remember what we did. We observed, and we checked it millions of times, that whenever we open door number 1 of 2 boxes and door number 2 of the third box, we're guaranteed to see an even number of red balls. And then, just using unassailable logic that everybody agreed with, we inferred that if we open door number 2 on all the boxes, we must see an even number of red balls. Okay, let's try the experiment. Well, that was kind of embarrassing. But it's probably an experimental error. These are tricky experiment, so let's repeat it just to check. Oh, well, the prediction was we'd see an even number of red balls, but we saw an odd number again. Let's check one more time. It's always an odd number of red balls. We check the experiment over and over again, and every time we find just the opposite of what we predicted. That's pretty weird. So, what's going on? What was our mistake? Well, we seem to have learned an important lesson. And the lesson is that we can be seriously misled by reasoning about things that might have happened but didn't really happen. It's a property of these boxes that you can open door number 1 or you can open door number 2, but you can never do both. Well, we thought it would be all right to say, if I had opened door number 1, suppose I saw a red ball, then I can infer that I'd see, say, a green ball if I opened door number 2. But that type of reasoning turns out to lead us astray, to be invalid. We use that type of contrary-to-fact reasoning all the time in the classical world, and it serves us well. But when we try to apply that reasoning in the quantum world, it doesn't work. These quantum systems obey a peculiar logic of their own that the human mind doesn't seem to be very well-equipped to grasp. Okay? So we just have to accept that that type of reasoning based on what would have happened if I opened door number 1, when in fact I opened door number 2, isn't allowed. And that's really weird. I think that's the essence of the weirdness about quantum theory. So let's think about putting it to work. Well, let's think about the complexity of information. Suppose, first of all, that I have 10 classical bits, balls and boxes, each one is either red or green. Well, there are a lot of possible ways to put the balls in the boxes, 2 to the 10, 1,024 ways. But for any one of them, I can give you a very succinct description of it by telling you, for each one of the balls, whether it's red or green. It's just 10 bits of information. Contrast that, though, with the case where I have 10 qubits. Now, it's not really right to say that each box contains a ball which is either red or green. The balls have some potential to be red or green, depending on whether we open door number 1 or door number 2. And there are rather intricate correlations among the boxes. So what I find when I open door 1 or 2 on one box is correlated with what I found when I open door number 1 or door number 2 on other boxes. And completely describing all those correlations requires a lot of classical information. So I have to write down about 1,000 numbers to completely describe a typical state of 10 qubits. And if I increase the number of qubits, the complexity of the description grows exponentially, so that if I have 20 qubits, I'd have to write down about 1,000,000 numbers just to describe all the correlations among a typical state of 20 qubits, or 1,000,000,000 numbers for 30 qubits. So with a still modest number of these quantum boxes or qubits, about 300 or so, if I wanted to write down, using classical information, a complete description of all the correlations among those quantum bits, in terms of classical information, I'd have to write down more numbers than the number of atoms in the visible universe. It'll never be possible, even in principle, to write that description down of the typical state of a few hundred qubits. That property of quantum information, that we can't hope to describe it for classical information when we have just a few hundred qubits, was intriguing in particular to Richard Feynman, the physicist, and it led him to ask about 25 years ago, could it be that if we perform a computation that acts on quantum states, a quantum computer, rather than on classical bits, we'd be able to perform tasks that are impossible with ordinary digital computers. Well, to think about that issue, it's helpful to think of an example of a problem that's hard for classical computers. So there's a game we can play with prime numbers, numbers that are divisible only by themselves and by one. It's a game like Jeopardy, actually. I give you the answer to a multiplication problem, and I tell you this is the product of two prime numbers, and you're supposed to tell me what two prime numbers I multiplied together to get 15, and you would, the question to which 15 is the answer is what? It's 3 times 5. And if I asked you what numbers did I multiply together, two prime numbers, to get 91, you'd be able to tell me the answer is 7 times 13. But you see, as the numbers get bigger, this gets to be harder. So suppose I told you it's 2,537, which I got by multiplying together two prime numbers. Any lightning calculators? If I gave you a few minutes and a pencil and a piece of paper, you'd be able to tell me that 2,537 is 43 times 59. Okay? But the difficulty of this game increases very rapidly as we add digits to the number. So in this case, where I have a 130-digit number, which is a product of 265-digit prime numbers, it's an extremely hard computational problem. It's not impossible. This one can be solved by a highly parallelized supercomputer in a time of order months. But for numbers which are much larger than this, it's just beyond the capability of digital computers to solve the problem of finding the factors. That's the answer. So here's a situation in which we can think about this question. Is it possible quantum computers would be able to do better? Factoring and some other hard computational problems can be characterized as kind of like looking for a key that fits a lock. That is, once we have the solution to the problem, we can easily verify that the key fits, that we have the right solution. We can multiply the numbers together and verify that they're the factors. And in principle, we could solve the problem by trying one key after another until we finally have the key that fits, trying all the candidate prime factors until we have the right ones, but we can never solve the problem in a reasonable amount of time that way. What a quantum computer enables us to do, roughly speaking, is try a vast number of keys in a vast number of locks all at the same time. The secret of the quantum computer is a kind of massive parallelism, which arises from this property that we can't describe quantum information succinctly using classical information. What it means is that for some purposes, we can achieve the same result by performing a quantum computation only once on a set of a few hundred qubits, as if we had performed the computation over and over and over again an incredibly large number of times, more times than the number of atoms in the visible universe, on a few hundred bits. And that parallelism allows us to speed up the solutions to some hard computational problems. But here's what that means in the case of factoring. Actually, the hardest factoring problem that's ever been solved, it was just done a few months ago, is factoring a 193-digit number, and it took 30 CPU years with a fast processor. Of course, it was a highly parallelized computation. And from what we know about the difficulty of this problem for classical computers, the best factoring algorithms that we have, we can estimate that that same processor would require a time much longer than the age of the universe to factor a 500-digit number. So we can't expect ordinary digital computers to factor 500-digit numbers anytime in the foreseeable future, even with great advances in technology. Suppose we had a quantum computer which was also just as fast as this classical one, like a gigahertz quantum computer. We don't have that yet, so we have to just suppose it for now. Then it would be able to factor the 193-digit number in a second and the 500-digit number in about 20 seconds. So the difficulty of the problem scales in a radically different way for a quantum computer than a classical one because of the power of this quantum parallelism. So it's really an amazing thing that the difference between what problems are hard and what problems are easy, the problems that we'll never be able to solve even with great advances in technology, and the problems that we should be able to solve someday with sufficiently advanced technology, The boundary between those two things is different because we're living in a quantum world instead of a classical world. In the quantum world, factoring is not much more difficult than multiplying two numbers together to find their product. So quantum computers would be, for some purposes, very impressive computational devices. So why haven't we built them already? Well, it's really hard. I'll come back to that in a minute. But you might wonder, are there issues of principle that might prevent us from ever building a quantum computer? And what comes to mind in particular is the problem of errors. Quantum computers are more susceptible to making errors than ordinary classical computers. Physicists sometimes like to assert that we can imagine in principle making a quantum state of a cat, which is a superposition of the dead and live state of a cat. A state of the cat which would be like one of those qubits, which wasn't really a red or a green ball, but somewhere in between. The cat would be in between alive and dead in the same sense. But we never see such superpositions of macroscopically distinguishable states in ordinary experience. And the reason why not is that a real cat always interacts with its surroundings, and the interactions with the environment, in effect, measure the cat. They project it onto a state which is either completely dead or completely alive. And a quantum computer, if and when we succeed in building one, won't be exactly like a cat, but like a cat, it will unavoidably, no matter how hard we try to prevent it, interact with its environment. And that, through the process that we call decoherence, will cause the information that the quantum computer processes to be damaged, and therefore our calculation to get the wrong answer. So in order to get a quantum computer to work, we have to find a way to fight off the destructive effects of decoherence due to interactions with the environment. Quantum computers are much more susceptible to noise than ordinary digital computers. Of course, even in the classical world, errors can be a problem. We all have bits that we cherish, and everywhere there are dragons lurking who delight in tampering with our bits. But we've learned some ways to protect ourselves against the dragons in the classical world. If I have a bit that I want to protect, I can store some backup copies of the bit, and then a dragon might come along and change the color of one of my balls. But I can employ a busy beaver who frequently checks the balls to see if one is a different color from the others. And when he sees that one is a different color, he repaints it so all three match again. So as long as the dragon hasn't had an opportunity to damage two out of the three balls, we'll be able to protect the information because it's recorded in a redundant fashion. And we'd like to use the same principle, that redundantly encoded information can be protected from error in the quantum world. But at first there seem to be obstacles to doing so. Because, as already noted, we can't copy unknown quantum states. So we can't do something as simple as store the backup copy of the state of a quantum computer in case the original gets damaged. And furthermore, in the quantum world, there are more things that can go wrong than for classical bits. If I have a qubit, a dragon might open door number one of a box, change the color of the ball, and then reclose the box. Or he might open door number two and change the color of the ball and reclose the box. Well, in the first case, that's really like a bit flip error that occurs in the classical world. But the second type of error, the error occurring through the other box, that's what we call a phase error in a quantum system, has no classical analog. And we have to find a way of protecting against both the bit flip errors, the classical errors, and the phase errors, the intrinsically quantum errors, if we want to protect quantum information. Well, despite these apparent difficulties, we have learned that it's possible by redundantly encoding quantum information to protect it from damage, much as we do in the classical world. If I want to protect a qubit from damage, it doesn't work now to store the qubit in a set of three qubits like we did with the classical bit, but we can do something just a little bit more complex. We can store one qubit of information in a correlated state of five qubits. And if we choose that encoding in a clever way, then if a dragon comes along and damages one of the qubits in some arbitrary way, we can hire our beaver to check the qubits, and by making a set of collective measurements on the qubits in this block of five qubits, he can collect enough information to diagnose the damage, to figure out which one of the qubits is damaged, and what kind of operation he needs to perform to correct the damage. So quantum information, too, can be redundantly encoded so we can protect it against errors, something we've only discovered in the last few years. So what might the hardware in a quantum computer look like? There are a lot of different possibilities that are being pursued in laboratories around the world. I'll tell you about one of the possibilities, which is to use an ion trap as a quantum information processor. We have the technology to, using electromagnetic fields, hold ions, electrically charged atoms, in a trap for a long time. And we can imagine that each one of these ions is in one of two quantum states, either in its ground state or lowest energy state, or in some particular excited state, which has a long lifetime. So we can think of them, again, as qubits, as objects which have two distinguishable states. Think of them as balls that are either red or green. Since these are just individual atoms, they're just tiny little fellas, you might think it would be hard to read out the state of a single atom. But actually, that's not very difficult nowadays. We can illuminate all of the ions with laser light. And if we choose the frequency of the laser appropriately, then the ions that are in the green state don't interact with the light at all, and so they stay dark. But the ions that are in the red state interact strongly with the light and glow visibly. So we can read out a series of zeros and ones, in effect, open the boxes on all of our qubits by shining a laser on them. This is an actual picture of a couple of beryllium ions in a trap at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. The ions are about 10 microns apart, so they're easily resolved. They're separated by a distance large compared to the wavelength of visible light. Of course, we want to do more than just read out the state of the ions in a trap. If we want to run a quantum computer, we want to process the quantum state of the ions. Here's how that could be done. I can address one of the ions in a trap with a pulse laser, and if I choose the frequency and duration of that laser pulse appropriately, nothing will happen to that ion if it's in the red state. But if it's in the green state, it'll undergo a transition driven by the laser from the green state to the red state, and a vibrational mode of all the ions in the trap will be excited. And then I can pick out another ion in the trap and address it with a pulse laser. And if I choose the frequency and duration of that pulse appropriately, then nothing will happen if the ions are not vibrating. But if the vibration has been excited, then that ion will undergo a transition from the red state to the green state. So what we've done is we picked out two ions in the trap. And if the first ion had been in the red state, nothing would have happened. If the first ion is in the green state, both of these ions undergo a transition. So if I prepare the first ion in a state which is neither red nor green, but a superposition of the two, and carry out this procedure, I can make a correlated or entangled state of the two ions in the trap. And many such operations in succession can be used to build up a quantum computation. So far, this type of quantum computation has been done only on a small scale, with up to 8 ions and a few hundred operations at most. If we want to do computationally interesting information processing, that has to be scaled up substantially to at least hundreds, probably thousands of ions, and millions of operations. And this type of protocol has actually been carried out in several labs in the last couple of years. So I've told you about how quantum information is different from classical information, how the boxes are not like the soxes, that we can't copy unknown quantum states, which is the basis of privacy in quantum cryptography, that there's no succinct way of describing a quantum state using classical bits, which opens the possibility that by exploiting quantum parallelism, we can greatly speed up the solutions to certain computational problems. I've told you that we can redundantly encode quantum states to protect them from the effects of noise, and that the first pioneering attempts to achieve coherent processing of quantum states in the laboratory are currently underway. So this young field of quantum information science has to credit these achievements. We've discovered some algorithms which, if we could run them on a quantum computer, would allow us to solve problems that we don't think can be solved with reasonable resources in the classical world, problems like factoring numbers. We've shown that there are cryptographic protocols like the quantum key distribution protocol that I told you about, which are achieved by exchanging quantum states and which we can prove are secure for arbitrary eavesdropping attacks allowed by the known laws of physics. we found schemes for protecting quantum information from damage so that it can be processed reliably, even with equipment that isn't perfect in the laboratory. And on the hardware front, there are now working prototypes that achieve quantum key distribution, quantum cryptography, and quantum gates or quantum information processing devices have been operated on a small scale in the physics lab. So some of the challenges we face are, well, to take all of these achievements further, to understand better what really is the power of quantum computing. What are the problems that quantum computers can solve that can't be solved with ordinary digital computers? We'd like to understand better the potential applications for a quantum internet. What else can be achieved in cryptography if we use quantum states, which achieves a higher level of security than we know how to realize in classical protocol? We'd like to see how the idea of quantum error correction can be realized in actual physical devices, and we'd like to conceive and build quantum hardware which can be scaled up to large systems that are potentially capable of solving very hard problems that we can't solve with ordinary digital computers. Meanwhile, thinking about the information processing capability of quantum systems is leading to useful insights into problems closer to the core of basic physics, and I think many such insights can be expected in the future. So coming back to Einstein to sum up, Einstein actually realized, more clearly than others at the time, the essential weirdness at the core of quantum theory, what we call quantum entanglement. To Einstein and some who followed him, this spooky action at a distance presaged some kind of emergence of a deeper theory that would eventually supersede quantum mechanics. It's been 70 years since the original paper by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. So far that hasn't happened. Quantum mechanics as it was formulated back in the 1920s still holds sway. But the insight that quantum entanglement signifies a very profound departure from the classical description of nature has been vindicated, and now we're facing the exciting challenge of putting that weirdness to work. Thanks for listening.
All right, we have some time for questions before we have to conclude for the day.
Well, so the question was, what's my prediction for when quantum computers will be available in the market? So you can't wait to buy one. Well, it's a very reasonable, good question. It's a hard question to answer. I think, to me, it would be a great surprise if it were to happen in 25 years or less. There are various paths we can imagine scaling up currently proposed technologies for achieving large-scale quantum computation. It doesn't. There's no insurmountable obstacle that we know of. It looks very hard from an engineering perspective, and it looks very expensive to build these big systems. It's not clear we have a strong enough incentive to do it. How important is it, really, to have a large-scale quantum computer is an important question. I mean, there's a lot of interest in quantum computing because of their potential power for solving number theoretic problems, which are of interest because they can be used to break cryptographic protocols that are currently in use, like the protocol that you use when you send your credit card over the internet. You know, you could use it to listen in on Al-Qaeda or something like that. So because of that application, there's a lot of interest in developing quantum computers. But I think we really need to have a better understanding of what the applications are before industry will see great commercial potential to make the investment that will be necessary, because it looks really hard. I think it will happen. I think it'll happen in the 21st century, because I don't see any reason why not, and I think the incentives are strong enough so that when we think of the right way of doing it at an acceptable cost, it will happen. Yeah, I think that's an accurate description of what Feynman said in his paper in 1981. Feynman's paper was actually about using a quantum computer to simulate quantum physics. And I think of the applications that have been proposed, that's probably the most interesting and far-reaching one even today. There are good reasons for wanting to be able to simulate complicated many-body quantum systems on computers to predict how those systems will behave. That has applications to material science, to ab initio chemistry, potentially to drug design, understanding how large molecules behave, and so on. That's very hard to do, or at least there are some versions of that quantum simulation problem, which we don't know how to do with reasonable resources on digital computers. And the reason for that is the same thing I was talking about today. It's because there's no succinct description of the relevant quantum states for describing, say, a large molecule. And so to describe it very accurately on a classical computer, nobody has enough memory or enough processing power to do that type of simulation. Quantum computers, we know in principle, could be used through efficient computation, efficient simulations, to study such problems, to make predictions about the behavior of large molecules and exotic materials. And I think that is going to be an important application for quantum computing. Yeah. Yes. So the ball was a little. So I gave the example of the photon polarization, which is probably a little easier to visualize what the two doors correspond to. That we can think of measuring the polarization of a photon along either one of two complementary bases. We can either say, okay, it's either horizontal or vertical, or we can rotate our polarization axes 45 degrees. And those two different choices for our polarization bases correspond to the two doors, and the two distinguishable polarization states correspond to the two colors. In the case of the ion, it's a little bit more subtle. Door one just corresponds to looking at the ion to see if it's in its ground state or in its first excited state. But door number two corresponds to observing the state of the ion in an unusual basis, where it's either a superposition of ground and excited with a plus sign or ground and excited with a minus sign. Yeah, that's right. I think one can get at the essence of these quantum correlations by just considering these two complementary bases. And we sort of saw that, because we could kind of get a feel for why it is that we can't copy unknown quantum states by just thinking about two bases. And we were able to understand my experiment with the three boxes, which I think reveals in kind of a stark fashion how the correlations among qubits are different than the correlations among classical bits. But of course, I didn't mean to imply that there are really only two ways to look at a qubit. There were just two that we wanted to consider in this talk. Yeah, and the two experiments each have their advantages and disadvantages. So in fact, the experiment that I described with the three boxes, for example, has also been done in an ion trap. So you can prepare a state of three ions which are entangled with one another, and you can measure them in either one of these two complementary bases and see that it's consistent with the behavior in the experiment that we did here today. And actually, so they did it first. I can't claim priority. So the disadvantage of the ion trap experiment is it takes a while to read out the state of an ion, and the ions are pretty close together. And so, at least in principle, there's time for information to travel from one ion to another before you read out the next ion. And so So it leaves open the possibility that there's some kind of communication between the ions which is consistent with relativity, because it's not communication that's faster than light, that explains the weird behavior. The nice thing about the experiment with photons is that Aspe and others have been very careful to assure that when the states of two photons are read out, that the choice of whether to measure in one polarization basis or another, that the choices are space-like separated events. So there isn't time for information to travel from when I decide to measure the photon by opening door one or door two over here to the guy over here who's going to decide whether to open door number one or door number two. The disadvantage of the experiment with photons is that photon detectors aren't perfect. Photon detectors have some imperfect efficiency, so you have to select only a certain subset of all the events in which your photon detectors clicked, and this opens the possibility that there's some kind of conspiratorial procedure determining whether the detector clicks or not, so that you could sort of, that's also considered to be a loophole for this type of test quantum correlation. So it's actually an interesting challenge for experimenters to do an experiment which overcomes both of these difficulties with sufficiently efficient detectors, like in the ion trap experiment, but with space-like separated measurement events, like in the photon experiment. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, will quantum mechanics eventually stop seeming weird?
Will we understand what the
order? Yeah, I don't know. I think surely it will. It will seem less weird probably with each generation as we become more accustomed. But I don't know if we'll ever feel. If we'll ever really have quantum brains, you know. I think there's something about the way we function as information processing animals in the classical world, which is which makes it a stretch for us to understand why the quantum world behaves the way it does, and that may not completely change. Yeah. Well, so your question was, can quantum computers really help with the things that we use computers for most of the time, like email? Would you want to do quantum email? Or would we want to do quantum word processing? I don't know, but quantum games would probably be a blast. But I guess to take your serious question was, what about hard combinatorial search problems? I guess is that was really what you were asking about. Yeah. Yeah. That's actually an interesting question. There are some computational problems which are believed, in a sense, to be harder than factoring, for example. The traveling salesman problem is an example of a problem which is the hardest in a certain class. That's the problem where you're told the distance between pairs of cities, and say you have 100 cities and you want to find the shortest route that visits all of the cities. We don't have a quantum algorithm for solving that problem and other similar problems. And there's some anecdotal evidence, the conventional wisdom is that such an algorithm won't be found, that quantum computers won't spectacularly speed up the solutions to problems like that. So it's actually a tricky business to get a better grasp on what are the problems that quantum computers really give us significant power for. It's something that we've only scratched the surface on, that we don't understand very well yet. Question in the back. Yeah. Now the question is, can quantum computers predict the weather? Yeah. Well, you know, as far as we know, there really is a fundamental limitation on weather prediction that quantum computers probably aren't going to help with, that there's a kind of chaotic dynamic, so that there's extreme sensitivity to initial data, so that over, say, a month's time, it's really probably impossible as a matter of principle to predict the weather. And I don't see that quantum computers will surmount that obstacle.
I was asked to wrap things up by around 5 o'clock, so I'd like to thank John for a very interesting talk.
Okay, well, this is sort of the end for this year, and I would like to, and I think we should all thank the speakers, John, for a wonderful talk, but all the other speakers. And David, wherever he is, David Absalom. who put this all together, and of course our staff, and Jocelyn in particular. And you all for coming. I mean, we really enjoy doing this. I know that you enjoy coming to this, but we really enjoy doing it, and we're going to keep on doing it. And please continue to give us advice and encouragement, and I'm sure come back. I remember an important thing. Yes, I finally remember. So we've been talking, I talked before, and got some reactions about how some people who just came here the first time found out about it, and do we advertise enough, and there were some suggestions of places we might. But, you know, I have a request from all of you. So, you know, go back, and you meet other teachers, tell them about this thing. And somebody also suggested writing an article that you could get published in the Physics Teacher. That's been tried before, failed, but try again. And please help us, you know, believe me, there are plenty of chairs out there that we would have liked to see filled. So even if you don't keep this as a secret, for your enjoyment only, spread it around. Don't worry. Spread the news around and tell your friends, write a letter to, or an article for the Physics Teacher, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you, and see you next year.